books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and as today's show is going out on Valentine's Day, I'll be chatting about romance during wartime with author Joanna Toy and our brand new book, A New Charter, at the Little Penguin Bookshop. Plus, we'll find four romantic books, brand new, in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Author Joanna Toy has been on Read On many times with her Shop Girl series, all six of which are available from RNIB Talking Books. And they've recently been joined by two brand new books in a brand new series about the Little Penguin Bookshop. We'll hear all about that series later on in today's show, but first my conversation with Joanna started with the Shop Girls. Book two in that series is the only one we haven't had on the show. It's called Wartime for the Shop Girls, and it's narrated by Becky Wright.
Reg! It's Reg! He's here!
Lily couldn't help herself. She'd been stationed at the window for the past 2 hours, as tense as a lookout in a South Coast pillbox. Now she tore to the back door the second she saw the latch on the back gate start to quiver. The hinge didn't even have time to squeak.
Mom! Jim!
She hollered excitedly over her shoulder.
He's home!
Then she was flying out over the yard bricks, her feet skidding on the frosty surface. A few days ago, the whole country had been blanketed in snow. Nearly 5 inches in their Midland town of Hinton, which had cast feverish doubt on Reg being able to get home at all. The snow had shrunk back now, leaving a scummy tide mark on the fringes of the yard, though it was still cold enough to make her eyes sting. But Reg was here, finally, and guaranteed a warm welcome. His 48-hour leave was in place of the family celebration they'd hoped to have at Christmas, insofar as anyone was celebrating Christmas in this the third already, winter of the war. If anyone had thought in 1939 that they'd still be fighting. Still, at least up to now it hadn't been as cold as that dreadful first winter, or as nail-shredding as the second, at the height of the Blitz.
Lil, for goodness sake, get back inside. You've only got your slippers on.
The first words from her brother, and he was telling her off. No change there. And Lily had to smile. But she wasn't surprised. Reg, bless him, was the oldest in the family, and had always been the sensible one, the responsible one. Or he had to be, after their father had died.
Way back in 2019, the first book in the Shop Girls series was published, and that's A Store at War. And that is the story of Lily, who goes to work at her local department store. This is in June 1941. Lily is only 14. She's from a very ordinary background, and she's rather daunted at first because although she's in a small Midland town, the department store, which is family-owned, still represents a very glamorous world. She's been used to doing her shopping at the market and in Woolworths. But she's very ambitious, is Lily. She's bright, and she's taken under the wing of her supervisor, Miss Frobisher, who sees her potential. And over the course of the 6 books that the Shop Girls became, we follow her journey, as it's called, the friends she makes in the store, the fellow shop girls, Gladys and Beryl. And equally, the war is unfolding around her. Her 2 brothers, one is in the army, one is in the navy. She's the daughter of a widowed mother who's working very hard for the WVS and the Red Cross. So it's a full sort of picture, really, of the store in its own little world, everything from the owner down to the guys in the brown coats who come around with the big baskets on wheels collecting all the rubbish, and equally her family life, which extends, of course, for all the girls to involve first boyfriends and then husbands and, in a couple of cases, babies.
And it does span quite a lot of the war. In fact, it goes beyond the war because they become the Victory Girls. And, well, it's no spoiler really, because you can look up and find the name of this book, but it ends with some wedding bells.
Yes, my progress through the war is quite slow, but there was so much happening. The thing about the war, it sounds very heartless to say it, is that in terms of writing a book, it delivers you an awful amount of plot because there is just always something happening. Our brothers are sent to various places, so people are in danger, maybe injured, brought back, whatever. And Lily, on her very first day, meets a young man who works in the store, Jim. And he eventually becomes Lily's husband, but as you say, not until book six in the series, because Lily is just 14 when she starts, which was, of course, the school leaving age. Jim is only 2 years older, so I had to progress their romance at a steady pace, and it was absolutely no problem to go on just that little bit after the war, because the war had a very long tail, as many of us remember. Rationing didn't finish till 1954, and there was a lot of reconstruction to do. But I mean, I like to think the books are overall hopeful and show really the community pulling together, not in that sort of particularly keep calm and carry on way, because they're human beings and they have their failings and they find the war frustrating and difficult at times. But it's really about the power of pulling together and getting through.
Her other brother, Sid, would have just clocked the slip as Red Pom Poms, called her Frou Frou or Fifi, he was always messing about with names, and made some crack about her pinching them off a French sailor. The fact that the British Navy, in which Sid was serving, issued its men with a plain flat-topped cap was a matter of some grievance with him, even though Lily was sure he'd have felt a right sissy in a hat with a pom-pom on it. But Sid was away down south at HMS Northney on Hailing Island. And much as they'd tried, he and Reg hadn't been able to coordinate their leave to get home together. When she gave in to despair, which wasn't often, Dora, their mum, sometimes wondered out loud when or if she'd ever have her three children under the same roof again. But it was no more than everyone else had to put up with. And as Dora was more likely to be heard to say in one of the many maxims she could produce to suit any occasion, "What can't be cured must be endured." "Come on inside, then." Lily hung on Reg's arm. "We'll get the kettle on." "I wouldn't say no." Poor Reg looked chilled through. His train must have been delayed. They mostly were these days, if not actually cancelled. And he'd probably had to hang about on a freezing platform. "Where's Mum?" "She's upstairs trying to keep herself busy and not watch the clock." "No, I'm not. I'm here." And there was Dora Collins, expectant in the scullery doorway. She was in her best dress in honour of the homecoming, with a Jack Ma scarf at the neck, no less, her Christmas present from Lily. Ever since she started at Marlowe's, the town's smartest department store, or so it liked to claim, Lily had promised herself that as soon as she could afford it, she'd buy her mum something nice. And when Marlowe's had given every junior a small bonus in gratitude for your hard work throughout the year in these difficult times, it had been earmarked straight away. Lily had only joined the store the previous June. She hadn't been expecting anything extra in her pay packet, so the few extra shillings had been a very welcome surprise. But Marlowe's was like that. It prided itself on looking after its employees, even though profits must be well down, for the simple reason that as the war ground on, there was less and less to sell. Still, the buyers, like Miss Frobisher, Lily's boss on children's wear, did the best they could, and the shop's reputation meant that if anything did become available, from tea trays to tobacco, children's coats to combinations, Marlowe's was one of the first places a supplier would contact.
That's Becky Wright reading from the second book in the Shop Girls series, Wartime for the Shop Girls. Now, Becky Wright has narrated most of the series. Did she sort of become the voice of the series in your head?
Yes, I knew Becky from her work on The Archers, where she played the character Nick Grundy. And I asked if she could be my reader because I knew how skillful an actress she was. The accent is quite a tricky one to master. Lily is from the Midlands, and the books are based on a real department store called Beatty's, which was founded in Wolverhampton. I made up a fictional place and a fictional store, but the setting is still notionally Birmingham, edging towards the Black Country. Now, the Black Country accent is particularly, well, original, can I put it like that? But might be quite difficult for people who haven't got their ear in, who are local to the area, to understand. And Becky just pitched it just right with enough sort of Midland to make it believable that Lily came from that area, as indeed do all her family and the other characters. But because Lily is working in a department store, it's that clever thing whereby she has a sort of a shop voice and a home voice. And there are just little gradations in Becky's performance that I think make it very subtle. Because I know Becky, I had some conversations with her before the reading of each book where we chatted about some of the characters. And she asked me, perhaps how did I envisage some of the other characters? Because they're not all Midland. There's all sorts of accents creep in. And she said to me, right, there's quite a challenge, in your books, Joan. Oh, really? I said, because I was thinking in terms of the main characters, like maybe 12 different voices or slightly different voices to do. But she pointed out that, for instance, in one book, Lily and Jim go to visit a woman who is quite well off, and a maid answers the door. So Becky had to come up with a voice simply for the maid to say, oh, good afternoon. Oh, you want to see Mrs. So-and-so? I'll see if she's available. And I just think what narrators do is so, so clever. I'm in awe of them, really.
Reg crossed the yard. Sid again would have bounded over and wrapped his mum in a hug, regardless of the rough, chilly wool of his tunic. But Reg, like Dora herself, was more reserved. He looked like her too, with soft brown hair, though his was now cropped short. Sid and Lily, on the other hand, had inherited their father's mop of fair curls. Reg kissed his mum on the cheek before she stood back to let him in. Come in, love, out of the cold, she urged, and let's have a good look at you.
You never fancy narrating one of your own books yourself.
Well, I've never been asked. It's funny, I'm just much happier, really, the other side of the microphone.
Now, we are moving from the shop to, well, a somewhat smaller shop with the Little Penguin Bookshop. Tell us about book one in that series.
The Little Penguin Bookshop is actually a station bookstall, and it's opened at the very beginning of the war, which was interesting for me because to start in 1939 as opposed to 1941, which was where the shop girls began. It's opened by a young woman, just 18, who is unable to join up in the war because her mother is something of a worrier. So, Carrie, my heroine, has a twin brother, Johnny, who is determined to get in the RAF and does very successfully and becomes a Spitfire pilot. Carrie is very keen to join up herself, but because her mother is a worrier, she realizes that to have two children under fire, as it were, would be too much for her. And so she's looking for something that she can do. So, on the day that war's declared, she goes for a walk. She happens to pass over the bridge which spans the tracks of her local railway station. And she sees troops, evacuees, children going off already to safety or arriving to more safety. She's in a suburb of London, distant suburb of London. And she thinks, well, what are they going to read? She's a big reader. She's always wanted to work with books and hasn't been able to. And she sees the shuttered bookstall and thinks, why shouldn't I open that up again? Then I can provide reading material for the troops, for the evacuees, for commuters going up and down to London on their daily business. So, with some help from an uncle who has got some little bit of money to put in to help her get started and to basically organize a loan, because a woman, certainly of her age, wouldn't be able to get a loan in her own name at that time. She opens it and she realizes that Penguin Books, in particular, with their cheap price and the fact that they're paperbacks, will sell very well. And she majors on selling those titles, hence the name, The Little Penguin Bookshop.
I've got it. Good, he said, surprised. What? Her words came out in a torrent. You know that saying, if the mountain won't come to Muhammad, Muhammad must go to the mountain? Well, it's the other way round. The mountain has come to me. Or rather, she gestured to the platforms below. The evacuation of London's children, along with their mothers or chaperones, had started as soon as Hitler had invaded Poland the previous Friday. Now the trains were full of troops, a seething mass of blue and khaki, heaving kit bags on and off, Army, Navy, and Air Force regulars and volunteer reserves. Well, Brockington Junction's the connection, isn't it? Reasoned Johnny. For the Army base at Caterham. And the Air Force squads must be on their way to Biggin Hill and Kenly by lorry. Exactly, said Carrie. And look at them, poor things. A few were peering hopelessly through the windows of the station's refreshment room, with its advertisements for PG Tips and Fuller's Walnut Cake. It was closed on Sundays. I see what you mean, mused Johnny. But there'll be a mobile canteen once the WVS get organised. Are you thinking of helping out? That'd be a great thing to do. I'm not talking about feeding their stomachs, cried Carrie. I'm talking about feeding their minds. Look. She pointed to where the station's former newsstand and bookstall sat shuttered and empty. They've been looking for someone to take it over since old Mr. Staples died, but no one'd risk it with everything being so uncertain, or so Dad told me. Well, now's our chance.
Is it?
Yes, don't you see? Anderson's can take over the bookstall, and I can run it. I may not be going to the front line, but those troops are. And the least they deserve is something to read. Johnny looked at her admiringly.
You could be onto something there, he said.
Of course I am. Carrie's conviction blazed from her. That'll be my contribution to the war effort. I don't know why I didn't think of it before.
And we'll have more from author Joanna Toy on our new series, The Little Penguin Bookshop, later on in today's show.
Brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
Close Knit by Jenny Colgan was given to us by Hodder.
I've told you about this before, said Mr. Wainwright as Gertie sat behind the till, her fingers, which had been clicking her needles under the register, now fallen silent.
When we're quiet, you dust.
Gertie bit her lip. But, said one of her co-workers, remember when you turned the heating down because it was too expensive? Gertie knitted us all vests. Yes, said one of the other women, Barb. I mean, it was a kind of nothing colour.
Gertie has always had her head in the clouds, wondering what her life might be like if she could only pluck up the courage to leave the remote Scottish island where she was born. It's the only place she knows, but she can't do anything there without everybody knowing. The glue of this close-knit community is the Knitting Circle, a group of strong, capable and frankly nosy women who work hard, gossip and knit and support each other through thick and thin. At the centre of this sisterhood is Gertie's mum, Jean, and her grandmother, Elspeth, and the three generations of women live together surrounded by wool in one cottage. When the chance comes to make changes, a new job working with an old school friend, Morag, on the local airline, new friends and even a possible new romance, a world of possibilities opens up before Gertie. Is this the way to make her dreams come true?
It was sandstone, said Gertie quietly. I thought it was a beautiful colour. But it worked perfectly. And I'd have had a lot more days off with my arthritis if it wasn't for the gloves,
chipped in Kel, who did the boxes out the back.
Although, yeah, what about a nice blue once in a while?
Mr. Wainwright scowled. This was not in the manual.
Dirty, go clean the windows.
This was clearly punishment, and Gertie sloped off.
Close Knit by Jenny Colgan is read by Ellie Beaton and runs for 10 hours and 35 minutes.
Simon and Schuster have recently given us Date with Destiny by Lucy Vine.
The trouble with spending half your life with six psychic predictions hanging over your head is that your friends never let you forget about it. You must be thinking about them, Mivanwi cries, struggling to be heard over the pumping music blasting out around us. Surely you're excited. Your birthday's in a week. You've been waiting 16 years for this. But it's silly, I shout back, and it's not like they're nice predictions anyway. I don't want them to come true.
Ginny is about to turn 32. It's a year she's been thinking about for a long time. 16 years ago, she crossed paths with a psychic who made some key predictions about her 32nd year. Three bad things: a heartbreak, a loss of independence, and a death. Three good things: a life-changing trip, reconnecting with someone, and meeting her soulmate. The issue is that Ginny is due to get married in a month. But it's all nonsense, obviously. But when some of those pesky predictions start coming true, she starts to wonder what might happen next.
She pouts. Some of them are nice. And, she shrugs, if it's your destiny, babe, it's your destiny. A woman beside us turns around. Did you say my name? We regard her blankly for a few seconds. Are you called Destiny? Mivanwi asks at last. She nods. Oh, I swallow awkwardly. Sorry, we weren't talking to you. She turns away and Mivanwi gives me a knowing look. See, Ginny, Destiny is literally here on your doorstep. Are you going to ignore it?
Date with Destiny by Lucy Vine is read by Sophie Roberts and runs for 10 hours and 46 minutes. And now on Read On, a return to my chat with Joanna Toy, author of The Little Penguin Bookshop and its very recently released sequel, A New Chapter at The Little Penguin Bookshop, both of which are read by Katie Sobey. Here's a clip from A New Chapter.
Carrie hurried back to the station, partly to relieve Uncle Charlie, but just as much to show off her present to Penny and Bet. The three of them had become fast friends. Bet was a woman in her 50s who ran the station refreshment room and didn't stand for any nonsense. She'd been the first to welcome Carrie when she'd opened up her bookshop in the early months of the war. Penny was a newer arrival, about Carrie's age. Dark-haired and dark-eyed, she'd arrived as a porter to replace Bet's son, Eric, after he was called up. She'd seemed rather standoffish at first, but that had been explained when Carrie had found out more about her, and the three of them got on famously now. Carrie got her usual thrill as she emerged from the booking office onto the platform and turned towards her bookshop. Strictly speaking, it was a bookstall, a large, green-painted cabin standing on the platform under the shelter of the station roof. Carrie sold newspapers, magazines and stationery oddments as well, doing a brisk trade. But it was for the books, the Penguin paperbacks in particular, that she'd become known. It still thrilled her to see her name painted over the counter in clear white letters. C. Anderson. Books, newspapers, magazines. Uncle Charlie was serving a customer a picture-goer magazine and gave her the thumbs up.
Aye, aye, here she is, Businesswoman of the Year. Nice lunch, love.
In reply, Carrie held out her wrist to show him the watch. Christmas present from Mike. Uncle Charlie gave a low whistle.
That's a nice piece. That didn't fall out of a cracker, did it?
I'm very lucky, Carrie acknowledged. Where's Penny? I'd like to show it to her, if you can hang on for 10 minutes.
Last seen going into the tea room on her break, said Uncle Charlie. With your brother.
Your previous books were published by HarperCollins. This is one of these cases where it could only have been published by Penguin, these books.
Yes, that's right. I don't know whether Penguin had in mind the fact that this coming year, this year, is the 90th anniversary of Penguin. The first books were published in the summer of 1935. But yes, I'm just very honoured to have been asked to do it and immortalise Penguin in this way.
Now, although we're recording this on a very stormy day, but this show, if everything goes well, should be broadcast on Valentine's Day. And romance finds Carrie in the Little Penguin bookshop in the shape of a dashing young officer.
Yes, there is always romance in this kind of book, historical fiction, saga, call it what you will. And on her birthday, again, because you have to get the ball rolling, Carrie makes one of those things that we now call a random act of kindness. This young chap is browsing the books at the bookstore and explains to her that he's got no change. He'd like to buy a book. He's got no change because he's spent the last of his money on a bunch of flowers, which are not for her, which leads to some confusion. And she gifts him a book. She gives him A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway, which was the book he'd been glancing through. And off he goes. He has to join his train. But he comes back to redeem himself and pay her the sixpence if she wants it. And that leads to their relationship.
Carrie hurried down the platform, past the poster urging people to ask themselves, is your journey really necessary? It made Mr. Bayliss, the station master, so indignant he huffed and puffed like one of the engines. As if he was going to be out of a job, what with the number of troop trains halting at Brockington Junction, the airmen disembarking for Biggin Hill and Kenley, and the soldiers doing the same for Caterham Barracks. Carrie glanced into his office as she passed and saw him brushing his bowler hat, his back to the fire. Fussy, self-important little man. Then she came to the tea room, with its battered metal signs advertising Brook Bond tea and Fuller's walnut cake, the door with the jangling bell above and the doormat set into the mosaic tiled floor. There, at the table nearest the stove, two dark heads were bent over a newspaper, chuckling together. Aha! Carrie exclaimed. Two birds with one stone.
Now we're moving on to book two, which is a new chapter, and there's no spoilers for book one, but as we open a new chapter, Mike has been sent to Washington as an envoy, leaving Carrie alone.
Yes, that's right. I mean, what you can be sure of in the war is that whenever you bring a couple together, they're going to be parted. So in book one, Mike had to go off to Dunkirk, and there was a lot of drama associated with his return. In book two, they have no sooner got back together than he is posted off to Washington. Now, this is really very good luck for Carrie and indeed for Mike, because he will be safe there. And it's particularly welcome as Johnny, who is Carrie's twin brother, is by now getting involved in, well, he's already been through the Battle of Britain. Of course, the Blitz is about to start. So, ironically, Mike is safer than Carrie, who is under the threat of nightly bombing raids. Johnny is not without his own dramas. And, of course, Carrie has by now made good friends with two other women who are on the station. The woman porter, young woman porter, Penny, and Betty, who runs the tea room and who has a waitress in there called Ruby. So all of the women, again, just as in the shop girls, on the home front, it was the women who were the kind of domestic army and kept things going. And Carrie needs her friends and family to support her when Mike is away, particularly because the bookstore comes under threat itself. So she has financial worries that she's got to overcome as well. Now, will Mike get back from Washington? What happens? I'll have to leave that hanging. But I do like a happy ending.
Penny sat back and Johnny jumped up to greet her. I heard you'd skived off.
I was not skiving.
Carrie gave her brother an affectionate punch on the arm. What's your excuse?
You don't mind if I have 24 hours off from helping to defend the skies?
Johnny retorted.
So you can sleep safe in your bed?
Johnny was a pilot, and not just any old pilot. He was one of the few, the Spitfire pilots who'd defeated the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain. He was so good, in fact, that he'd been given a training role, but he was itching to get back in the air, and Carrie knew it wouldn't be long before he wore his superiors down and they had to let him.
Now, book one and book two, if it's not in the RNIB library just now, as you're listening to this, it's on its way very soon. They're both narrated by Katie Sobey. Were you involved in her casting?
Penguin sent me three samples of potential readers, and I like Katie's voice because it's fresh and young, and it's got that sort of hopeful and optimistic quality that I wanted in Harry and my heroine. I think she sounds as if she's got a bit of spirit, really.
For now, she was enjoying the relief. She and her parents had had enough scares when he was flying, and if he was ground-based, he was at least a tiny bit safer.
Do you want one?
He indicated the half-drunk cups of tea on the table. No time, said Carrie. Talking of which... She extended her wrist from her coat sleeve, and Johnny whistled.
So that was the police cars we heard. Daring daylight raid on a jeweller's.
You are a clot, Penny spoke up. She's had lunch with Mike, hasn't she? I bet that's a present from him.
Spot on, Carrie admitted.
Like it?
It's gorgeous, Penny said kindly.
And it was kind, because Penny was estranged from her family and didn't seem to have anyone that she cared about or who cared much about her. Now she drained her cup and stood up, ramming her porter's cap on her dark curls.
I'd better get back too, she said, shooting Johnny a cheeky look. Us working girls are winning the war as well, you know.
Johnny held up his hands in a mock gesture of surrender.
Two against one. Hardly fair, he grinned. But do go on. Do your worst. I'll see you at home, he added to Carrie. I've got news.
That's a clip of Katie Sobey reading from a new chapter at the Little Penguin Bookshop. Now, do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I'm a great listener to audiobooks, both as readings and as dramatisations. So I download a lot of things from Radio 4 and from Radio 4 Extra. I'm very fortunate to be cited and I can enjoy a printed book. But there are times when audiobooks are just what you need, you know, the usual thing, journeys, holidays. And yes, I've got quite wide-ranging tastes.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we're downloading a book from the RNIB library is the cover. Could you give us a little audio description of the cover of A New Chapter?
Right. So A New Chapter at the Little Penguin Bookshop shows you, Carrie, as you might expect, holding a pile of penguin books. She's standing on a station platform of a sort of old-fashioned station, not those sort of modern garish ones with blaring announcements. And looming over her shoulder is a wonderful steam engine, which is obviously on its way somewhere.
And she's holding those penguin books with the iconic covers, the orange and white covers.
Yes, that's right. I mean, Penguin's marketing was a stroke of genius, really, on behalf of Alan Lane, who was the founder. So fiction was orange and white, crime green and white, biography blue and white, travel pink and white. So it was terribly easy to go to the different sections according to what your reading tastes were. And as I said, I think earlier, they were sixpence. They were paperback, which was quite a novelty at the time. And brilliantly, they would fit. It was particularly brilliant in wartime because they would fit in the pocket of a battle dress uniform. And sixpence was the same price as a packet of cigarettes. So they were really a bargain. Books had been as much as 7 and 6 for a hardback. And Alan Lane was very democratic and he wanted everybody to read good books. And that's exactly what Penguin was about, and what I hope a new chapter at the Little Penguin Bookshop is also a good book.
Now, you've mentioned Radio 4, and we talked briefly about Becky Wright being in The Archers. And you've got quite a long association with The Archers, haven't you?
I have a very long association with the Archers. I joined in 1980, and with a couple of forays into TV, I was associated with the Archers for probably 25 odd years off and on. But I've just always been happier with words than pictures, whether spoken or written. And I really owe the Archers everything. I started as a production assistant, PA, which involved retyping the scripts, which in those days came in on a hard copy. And as I did so, I was seeing what the editor was crossing out. So I could see what dialogue he considered either boring, in which case he'd just write in his own, or which wouldn't work in studio, if the writer had got someone saying, "But surely, Shula, you can see, it's a bit sibilant." So that was going to be perhaps tricky for the actor to say. So he would change that line. And I think I've carried a lot of that over into the books. I think the books are, I wouldn't say dialogue heavy, but I love writing the dialogue. The Archers is, the dialogue is very colloquial. It's very, got to be very appropriate to the character. So, somebody like Eddie Grundy is going to speak in a very different way from Oliver Sterling and so on and so forth, not just in terms of the accent, but the vocabulary and the whole word usage. And of course, the Archers being in what were then 15-minute episodes, now 12 and a bit. There's a hook at the end of every episode. There should be a hook, I was taught, at the end of every scene. So I've definitely tried to carry that over into my chapters and less so into the books, because all the books, having said they're a series, all my books can be read as standalones. So there is always a little up sum of who the characters are, a little thumbnail sketch, just a very short recap, so that you can start at any point with any book and know where you are in the series. But The Archers was just a great learning and living experience for me. Having started in the office, I went on to the script writing team in the middle 80s. Then I came back into production in the late 80s to the mid 90s. And then I went freelance as a script writer for 20 years.
This might be quite a geeky sound engineer thing to say, but for a good 15 years of that time, they would have been recording and editing on tape. It would have been razor blade and sellotape. Were you ever involved in that side of things?
Yes, I mean, not technically. I knew when I joined the BBC that there was absolutely no way I was going to be joining the audio department because that absolutely would be too scientific for me. But yes, I mean, when I progressed a little bit into other jobs in the office, part of the task was to go into studio with an audio engineer and make up the omnibus programme. In which case, then in those days, again, a scene was cut from each episode to make 5 15-minute minutes fit a 1 hour omnibus slot on a Sunday. So the engineer would be physically cutting with a razor blade, lifting out the tape, spooling it out, making the join work with a bit of tape, playing it back, and so on and so forth. So yes, all those great days of the Ewer and the and reel-to-reel tape, I remember them well.
Next day, as soon as Brockington Junction's commuters, soldiers, airmen, and sundry other passengers had boarded their trains with their copies of The Times, The Mirror, Titbits, Women's Own, or A Chosen Penguin, and Penny had finished unloading a stack of crates, Carrie beckoned her over. Penny seemed quite shocked at Johnny's news. "Flying again? He didn't say anything to me." Carrie frowned. "No, well, he wouldn't, would he? He wanted to tell us first." Yes, of course," Penny said quickly. "Silly of me. Anyhow, what are you doing all Friday?" Carrie straightened the newspapers and magazines laid out across the counter. I want to see Waterloo Bridge. They say Vivian Leigh and Robert Taylor are really good. A bit soppy for Mike, is it? Asked Penny shrewdly. Probably. But in any case, he's at a send-off for some colonel who's leaving. So, are we on? Sorry, said Penny. I don't think I can. Oh, okay. But Carrie frowned again. Penny never usually turned down a night at the cinema. For one thing, it was warmer than the room she rented in a shared house. Yet this was the third time in a fortnight, and with no real explanation. Another time, Penny called over her shoulder, moving off. I'll have to go. There's a divorced bicycle wheel I've got to reunite with its owner, and a stack of parcels to get ready for the 9:52. See you.
That was another clip from a new chapter at the Little Penguin Bookshop by my guest Joanna Toy and narrated by Keithy Sobey. And Joanna, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you. It's been such fun.
Brand new books available now from RNIB Libraries.
Garden of Delight by Erica James was donated by Orion.
Lucy's last job of the day was to water the plants. It was something she always enjoyed doing, not only because it brought out her nurturing instinct, but also because of the sense of power it gave her. Wielding a hose was a bit like holding a loaded gun. Nobody, if they knew what was good for them, was going to argue with her.
Anything can happen when a group of strangers find themselves on holiday together. The Gardens of Delight brochure promises the opportunity to visit some of the most beautiful and enchanting gardens in the Lake Como area of Italy. For Lucy Gray, assistant manager at Meadow Hill Garden Centre, the chance to go to Italy offers more than just gardens. Lake Como is where her father lives. Recently married, Helen Madison Tyler and her wealthy husband have just moved into the old rectory in Swanmere. With her husband spending so much time away from home, Helen throws herself into caring for the garden. Conrad Truman isn't interested in gardening. Widowed for 5 years, his life revolves around work and humouring Mac, his curmudgeonly elderly uncle, who has expressed a desire to go on the Gardens of Delight tour. Reluctant, Conrad agrees to go. Anything for a peaceful life, he concedes. But a peaceful life is the last thing any of them are in for.
This sense of power first came to her at school at the age of 15, when she was put in charge of the ramshackle greenhouse while their biology teacher, a nervous, stammering man, was called to the telephone in the secretary's office. His parting words as he scurried away, his pregnant wife was 2 weeks beyond her due date, were, "Don't touch anything while I'm gone." He might just as well have said, "Feel free to trash the place." Within minutes, Lucy had everyone positioning the empty plastic and clay flower pots on the bench at the furthest end of the greenhouse into a makeshift coconut shy and was taking aim with the hose. The first clay pot to take a direct hit from the blast of water fell to the floor with a clattering smash. Another followed suit, then another. Aha! Take that! Lucy felt an exhilarating surge of triumph. She was invincible. She was all-powerful. She was the business. She was also up to her neck in trouble. The teacher who had been hastily dispatched to replace Mr. Forbes appeared in the doorway of the greenhouse to find a scene of what she later described to the headmistress, somewhat overdramatically in Lucy's opinion, as Armageddon.
Gardens of Delight by Erica James is read by Jenny Seagrove and runs for 6 hours and 8 minutes.
Sylvia's Second Act by Hilary Yablon was given to us by Orion.
I admit it. I have fantasies. Of course I do. Who doesn't? If I were to make a list of my own fantasies, the ones that pop into mind would be the following. To be a runner. I turned 63 last month. I'm sure my body would be in for quite the shock. But boy, would I just love to wake up and pull on a pair of those adorable running shorts I see the girls in these days. I actually thought about getting into it after my daughter Isabel joined the cross-country team in high school. I thought we'd go for mother-daughter runs, but somehow things were always too busy. Izzy had a million activities. I was always in the car driving her somewhere, like all the other Connecticut housewives.
Growing older doesn't just mean growing wiser, but it does mean a lot of fun. When 63-year-old Sylvia finds her husband in bed with another woman, she's shocked and furious at first. But by the time her head stops spinning, Sylvia realizes she hates the retirement community she's living in. It's for old people, and she certainly doesn't feel old. So she enlists the help of her best friend, glamorous 70-year-old widow Evie, and the pair flee to Manhattan to start a new life in the city that never sleeps. Sylvia's husband may have lost her life savings, but they're scrappy and determined, and they weren't born yesterday. Before long, Sylvia is reviving her wedding planning business and even finds herself back in the dating game. And no matter what her meddling daughter thinks, it's her time now, and she's determined that in this glorious second act, the best is yet to come.
I used to fantasize about leaving Connecticut, even just for a night. Taking the train into Manhattan and trying one of those hot new places people were always talking about. Having a glass of wine at the bar and then... Okay, the truth is that I fantasized about that almost every day after Izzy left for college. Now I fantasize about going back there and leaving this dreadful Florida retirement community my husband Lewis insisted we move to. Boca Beach Gables. BBG, for short. Don't get me wrong, it's very nice, very pretty, very upscale, very pink. But I hate the sun. I hate the humidity. I hate the way the days feel stretched out and empty. I have never felt so alone.
Sylvia's Second Act by Hilary Yablon is read by Jane Oppenheimer and runs for 10 hours, 21 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Joanna Toy for the Books of Her Life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Oh, there are so many. I can't believe you're asking me for just one. But I will go for, and it's probably quite a popular choice, Little Women by Louisa M. Alcott. I'm a Joanna. Jo in the book, I think, was probably a Josephine. But I really, really identified with her and her constant reading, her taking herself away from her noisy family to read in the attic with a bag of russet apples. And of course, she did manage to fulfill her ambition. I just thought it was a great story. I haven't actually got sisters. I'm an only child. But in the same way, I was living a lot in my own imagination, as I think Jo did. And it really resonated with me.
Jo? Jo, where are you? Cried Meg at the foot of the garret stairs. Here, answered a husky voice from above. And running up, Meg found her sister eating apples and crying over The Heir of Radcliffe, wrapped up in a comforter on an old three-legged sofa by the sunny window. This was Jo's favourite refuge, and here she loved to retire with half a dozen russets and a nice book to enjoy the quiet and the society of a pet rat who lived nearby and didn't mind her a particle. As Meg appeared, Scrabble whisked into his hole. Jo shook the tears off her cheeks and waited to hear the news. Such fun! Only see! A regular note of invitation from Mrs. Gardiner for tomorrow night, cried Meg, waving the precious paper and then proceeding to read it with girlish delight. Mrs. Gardiner would be happy to see Miss March and Miss Josephine at a little dance on New Year's Eve. Mommy is willing we should go. Now, what shall we wear? What's the use of asking that when you know we shall wear our poppins because we haven't got anything else? Answered Jo with her mouth full. If only I had a silk, sighed Meg. Mother says I may when I'm 18, perhaps. But 2 years is an everlasting time to wait. I'm sure our pops look like silk, and they're nice enough for us. Yours is as good as new, but I've got the burn and the tear in mine. Whatever shall I do? The burn shows badly, and I can't take any out. You must sit still all you can, and keep your back out of sight. The front is all right. I shall have a new ribbon for my hair, and Mommy will lend me her little pearl pin. And my new slippers are lovely, and my gloves will do, though they aren't as nice as I'd like.
That's Gretel Davis reading from Little Women by Louisa May Alcott, available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily go back to, curl up with and reread?
I would go back to My Cousin Rachel by Daphne du Maurier. I just think she was such a genius at combining mystery and romance and suspense. Brilliant descriptive writing. In my head, every time I read it, I come to a different conclusion about My Cousin Rachel. Was she good? Was she bad? Who's right? Who's wrong? I just think it's so clever and it's so beautifully written.
I think what shamed me most was the delight of his friends, their real pleasure and true thought for his welfare. Congratulations were showered upon me as a sort of messenger to Ambrose, and in the midst of it all, I had to smile and nod my head and make out to them that I had known it would happen all along. I felt double-faced, a traitor. Ambrose had so tutored me to hate falsity in man or beast that suddenly to find myself pretending to be other than I was came near to agony. The best thing that could have happened. How often I heard the words and had to echo them. I began to shun my neighbours and skulk at home around the woods rather than face the eager faces and the wagging tongues. If I rode out about the farmlands or into town, there was no escape. Tenants on the estate or acquaintances from here and there had but to catch a glimpse of me and I was doomed to conversation. An indifferent actor, I forced a smile onto my face, feeling the skin stretch in protest as I did so, and was obliged to answer questions with a kind of heartiness I hated, a heartiness that the world expects when there is mention of a wedding.
My Cousin Rachel by Daphne du Maurier is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by Jonathan Price. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
Well, I really love the British Library crime classics, and I read a lot of them because when I'm writing, I can't read anything that is too similar to my genre. It just makes me too self-critical. And I'm thinking, oh no, I've got to improve. I love these books because I'm very immersed in the 1940s and 50s. And the sort of the social attitudes that they portray, the language, they're very, very helpful to me in giving me the right kind of atmosphere for what I am writing. So one I've recently read and particularly enjoyed is called Somebody at the Door by Raymond Postgate, who became better known as a food critic. I think he started the Postgate Guides or something like that. And I had no idea he was a crime writer. It's his second book. And I think it's particularly appropriate for your programme because for a sighted person, it has one of the best descriptions of the blackout and what it is like, what it might be like for a sighted person to lose their sight and not to be able to see. It's all set in January 1942, so a bleak and dark night when the main protagonist, who becomes the murder victim, in fact, is catching a train from London to his suburban home. The station is in darkness. The roof of the station is just a dark arc against this black, moonless night. You know, at one point he goes into the refreshment room where he leaves the dimness of the platform into the bright light of the cafe. And my father had two detached retinas, macular degeneration, and was blind at the end of his life. And that was a gradual process. And I know he found the transition from dark to light very, very hard to manage. And I just found it very, very resonant of that. It's also just a brilliantly written book because it actually goes into the backstories of the five potential suspects for the murder, sort of from their point of view. So I just think it's really original and I really enjoyed it.
By 6 o'clock, when the darkness was pitch black, the thermometer touched the lowest point yet that winter. On this dreary day, probably the dreariest place was a railway terminus. Those who were hurrying to catch the 6:12 at Euston may have thought so, if they had any thoughts to spare from their aching ears and fingers. One of them, Councillor Henry James Grayling, a thin man looking about 50, cursed the station and the railway company aloud. Entering from the side, not through the grotesque, vast, black Euston arch, he had slipped on the frozen cobbles nearly in front of a lorry coming out in the darkness. He had fallen on his side and had only been saved from injury by young Evetts, an assistant in the chemist department of his own firm, a man whom he did not like or trust. He had not known Evetts was near to him. He did not like the officious way in which the young man pulled him to his feet and ran his hands all over his clothes. "I'm all right, thank you." "Disgracefully dangerous place." "Confound the company," he said ungraciously and reluctantly.
Somebody at the Door by Raymond Postgate, part of the British Library Crime Classics series, is available commercially as narrated by Simon Darwin. And once again, Joanna Toy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.